From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, vaccine epidemic. Get ready for that, but here's what's happening. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano has warned that the threat of terrorism against the United States was in some ways at its most heightened state since the 9/11 attacks. In addition to the threats by Al-Qaeda, the militant group behind the attacks nearly a decade ago, she says, the country faces new threats from those inspired by the group and those already within the United States. The guy who monitors terrorist activity, Doug Hagman, on the line with us. Douglas, what does this all mean? Does she know something we don't?
Well, if she does, certainly we're not seeing it, George. We've been monitoring the very instruments on the Internet and also the communications and looking at the various communications within the departments of our government. And I'll tell you what, there's nothing to indicate at this particular point any heightened state of alert.
Then how can she say these things?
Well, you know what? I think historically we have to look at what happened prior to the 1995 bombing, the legislation that was taking place back then. I believe, and Tom Ridge in his book backs us up a little bit, that a lot of this is political in nature. That you know, we need when there's pending legislation like the Patriot Act, for example, that failed to pass.
Yeah, three provisions.
Right. I believe that they come out with these scare tactics, and I think this is all part of security theater and the illusion of a threat. The threat's there, but it certainly we're not seeing an increased level of threat with respect to this.
Okay, and they don't have anything definitive that they're holding?
No, not at all.
All right, thanks, Doug. Doug Hagman, his website, you'll find it on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. The latest startling revelation to come via documents leaked to Julian Assange's WikiLeaks website. U.S. officials think Saudi Arabia is overpromising on its capacity to supply oil to a fuel-thirsty world, and they say that sets up a scenario, the documents show, whereby the Saudis could dramatically underdeliver on output by as soon as next year, sending fuel prices soaring. A new drilling technique opening up vast fields of previously out-of-reach oil in the western United States, helping reverse a two-decade decline in domestic production of crude. Companies are investing billions of dollars to get at oil deposits scattered across North Dakota, Colorado, Texas, and California. By 2015, oil executives say the new fields could yield as much as 2 million barrels of oil a day, more than the entire Gulf of Mexico produces right now. More than 15 million American homeowners currently owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth. They're underwater. The numbers indicate the higher foreclosure rates could be on the horizon. Another powerful blizzard howled through the nation's midsection, piling up 2 feet of new snow on parts of Oklahoma and Arkansas. Everybody else is already buried, still struggling to clean up from last week's epic storm. Stan Dale with us as he monitors all kinds of weather conditions. Stan, when is this going to stop?
I don't know, George. In fact, I think it's probably going to get worse for the next couple of years. The La Nina situation is looking like we're going to have back-to-back La Ninas, according to Joe Bastardi over at AccuWeather.
Mm-hmm.
These things are strongly linked to the solar activity, to sunspot activity. The decrease in the number of sunspots in this current solar cycle worries me a bit, and it does worry Joe and others in that we see what looks like a miniature ice age, you know, like a
well, it feels
minimum.
Like it. Yeah, it feels like the Midwest is freezing right now, Stan.
We're running some tests at the moment with a number of volunteers across the planet, and the tests we're running are trying to find out if the telluric or subsurface electric currents in the earth are changing their normal patterns of flow. They're linked to the output of the sun, and these underground earth currents are strong enough, like you're up to 1,000 to 2,000 amp currents, to affect thunderstorms, to turn rainstorms into real thunderstorms. So these may be directly affecting then the weather patterns across the whole planet, which then begs the question, is the solar wind, even though it's weaker, is this interaction with the Earth's magnetic field causing this, and is the Earth's magnetic field itself changing?
We're going to talk with you at depth about this in the next week on Wednesday, Stan, so you're going to be with us. And by the way, in less than 2 hours, happy birthday, Mr. Dale.
Hey, thank you. Yes, I'm going to be another year older. Wow.
And wiser. We'll talk to you next.
Let us hope.
Talk to you next week. Apple has started manufacturing a new version of its iPad tablet computer with a built-in camera and faster processor. The new iPad will be thinner and lighter than the very first model. I predict that thing will sell off the shelves. A new app for devices like the iPhone and the iPad aims to take the intimidation factor out of confessions for Catholics, and the church is giving it its thumbs up. So all you have to do is, you still have to go see a priest, of course, to confess your sins in person, but this confession app holds your hand through the process via your handheld. How about that? The company behind Guitar Hero is pulling the plug on one of the most influential video game titles of the new century. Activision, which also produces the Call of Duty series, is ending the Guitar Hero franchise after a run of more than 5 years. An asteroid about the size of a car made a close pass by Earth Wednesday, the second space rock in 5 days to fly near, but posed no threat of hitting the planet. The asteroid is called 2011 CA7, flew within 64,300 miles of the planet. It's about 9.5 feet across and was discovered by astronomers earlier this month. And in 2004, of course, scientists announced that there was a very slight chance that Apophis, an asteroid larger than 2 football fields, could smash into the planet in 2029. Well, later, after they did some number crunching, they said, nope, the chance of this hitting, very doubtful indeed. But now reports out of Russia say that scientists believe that Apophis will collide with the planet on April 13th, 2036. These reports conflict on the probability of such a doomsday event, but the question remains, how scared should we be? Up next, physicist Michio Kaku joins us. We'll talk about this and some other incredible science issues on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Dr. Michio Kaku, theoretical physicist, author, radio television host as well, co-founder of the String Field Theory. He's with us this hour on Coast to Coast. Michio, welcome back.
Glad to be on, George.
My pleasure, too. Hey, this story about this asteroid with these Russian scientists saying it's going to hit us, what's your take? What do you feel about that, Michio?
Well, it's enough to make anyone nervous. First of all, no one disagrees on the basic facts that, first of all, on Friday the 13th, April 13th, 2029, Apophis makes its first pass around the planet Earth. So close, you'll see it with the naked eye. It'll be brighter than a star, whizzing right overhead underneath our satellite. So there's no doubt about that. We're going to have a near miss Friday the 13th, April 2029. But here's where the disagreement comes in.
Okay.
Depending on precisely the trajectory as it skims the atmosphere of the Earth, it all depends, therefore, on the second pass. Now, of course, it's very difficult to predict how asteroids move through the atmosphere. Friction is very hard to compute using a computer. And so there's a source of disagreement. But on the second pass, it comes back again on April 13th, this time 2036. And on the second pass, that's where the disagreement comes in now. So depending on how it slows down, and how it hits the atmosphere on 2029 will determine exactly what happens on 2036. And there's also no disagreement about the impact. The impact would be beyond comprehension. It would take out France. It could take out Germany.
Oh, my God.
This is not a city buster like what hit Russia in 1908 in Siberia, in Tunguska. This is not a city buster that can take out New York or London or Paris. This is a nation buster.
Oh.
This is an object twice the size of a football field, about 1,000 feet across, bigger than the Rose Bowl.
Is it a planet killer, Michio? Because if it takes out, let's say, France, wouldn't the debris just block the sunlight around the planet for God knows how long?
Yeah, well, a planet buster would be a few miles across, like what took out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. That's an object about 6 miles across that plowed into Mexico, the Yucatan of Mexico, 65 million years ago. That created a huge firestorm and blocked the sunlight, causing temperatures to plunge. And in about a year's time, the dinosaurs all died, in about a year. This is going to be smaller, but again, it'll be beyond human comprehension. First of all, the shockwave of the impact will be going out maybe perhaps 50 to 100 miles.
Oh, my.
Then you have the blast wave coming out and the firestorms, which are going to go out a few hundred miles with meteorites landing in all directions. And that, in turn, is enough to take out Germany, take out France. If it were to hit the United States, it would take out Texas and a good chunk of Mexico and other states as well.
If it hit the ocean, Michio, what kind of a tsunami would it create, let's say, on the eastern coast of the United States?
Oh, the tsunami would be horrible. It would be several miles tall, and it would hit the coastline of the United States and just keep on going.
Oh, my.
It would just keep on going and take out many, many states on the Northeast. Perhaps all of New England would be submerged as a consequence of this. And again, a city buster like would hit Siberia. They come about maybe once every 100 or once every few hundred years. But mostly they hit the oceans, so we don't really know about it. And, you know, hundreds of years ago, there were very few big cities on the world. Big cities are a relatively recent phenomenon.
That's right.
But now we have cities, and now we have populated most of the Earth, and so you can imagine what the property damage would be on the second pass on April 13th, 2036 now, if it were to come close. And this is where the disagreement comes in. The head of the Russian Space Agency last year shocked a lot of people by saying that we should start to prepare for the impact, because the impact cannot be dismissed. This recent statement coming from Russia is also startling because they seem to disagree with NASA. NASA's been poo-pooing the whole thing.
That's right.
Saying that the chances of an impact are one in 250,000. But again, a lot depends on the luck of the draw. A lot depends on how it skims the atmosphere of the Earth in 2029. So this is where all bets are off.
Well, we'd have 25 years to prepare for this arrival. Don't you think by that time we would develop some technology in order to just blow it up?
Well,
or does that
think,
create a
right?
bigger... Yeah.
However, everyone has this image of Bruce Willis...
landing on an asteroid, yeah.
However, the space shuttle is going to be phased out. There's not going to be a space shuttle. And second of all, the space shuttle couldn't even reach Apophis. The space shuttle simply spins wheels around the planet.
Right.
That's all it does. It never goes into deep space. And that's what you need. You need a new booster rocket.
Yeah, you couldn't blow it up in our atmosphere. It'd be too close, right?
It'd be too close. You have to go into deep space, meet it halfway out there, and then perhaps nudge it out of the way. The farther it is away from the Earth, the easier it is to nudge it. Put a rocket, for example. Put a rocket on Apophis and let the rocket push the asteroid a little bit. There are other methods that have been proposed. Another is a gravity attractor. That is, if you have a spaceship big enough and it's close enough to Apophis, then it may use its own gravity to nudge the asteroid out of the way. And blowing it up, well, that's been considered too. The problem is you might have lots of baby asteroids coming in.
Yeah, that's scattered all around the planet then, hitting cities like crazy.
Yeah. So you might lose a nation buster, but you might have instead many, many city busters coming at you.
Isn't it a matter of just when? I mean, eventually, we're going to get hit by something, aren't we?
Yeah, I think we have to come to the realization that it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. Sooner or later, there's going to be a big one. And realize that these asteroids come by the Earth and catch us off guard. We, at the present time, have the most primitive detection system where we can, by luck, see a meteorite before it lands. But most of the time, they wander right past the Earth, and we are clueless. We are clueless about their presence.
I mean, we could wake up in the morning, watch television, listen to the radio, and we will be seeing events of, especially now with live satellite television, we could see a city just taken out with a huge crater.
That's right. You know, comets, for example, some of them are long period comets. They come from what is called the Oort cloud, far, far away. They are unpredictable. We have no way of predicting their trajectory. And conceivably, in a worst case scenario, they could come by the backside of the sun. So we wouldn't even see it as it went by the backside of the sun. And it could be making its first pass around the sun. So there's no tail. It's what's called a virgin comet. It's covered with soot. It has no tail. It whips around the backside of the sun and then comes by the front side of the sun and catches us totally off guard. And the impact would be in about a month. So our telescopes would then see the tail as it emerges from the front side of the sun. But then we just have a month before it impacts on the Earth.
And I don't want to be morbid here, Michio, but I trust death would be instantaneous and there would be no suffering by people who get hit by this?
Well, it depends on how big it is. Comets come in all sizes. A Halley's Comet, the most famous comet, is about 20 miles across. We've actually photographed it. And it's in the shape of a peanut, actually. So sooner or later, it'll break apart into two comets. And we'll have two comets instead of one when Halley's Comet splits apart. But it's 20 miles across. It's considerably bigger than the object that plowed into Mexico 65 million years ago, taking out the dinosaurs, and then paving the way for us, for humans. We, in some sense, owe our very life to that object that plowed into the Yucatan 65 million years ago, wiping out our competitor, the dinosaurs.
Why would NASA be at odds with the Russians over Apophis? Wouldn't mathematics be the same and computer models be the same?
You think. I mean, first of all, it was Dr. Leonid Sokolov who made that statement that was carried by international wire services. So I've been getting a lot of phone calls saying, what are the Russians saying? And I think we're going to have to ask Professor Sokolov to clarify his remarks. But I think the thrust is that the Russians take this much more seriously than the United States. They're saying that there's a lot of black magic involved in terms of calculating the precise trajectory of this object, especially when it's going to come so close to the planet Earth in 2029 that you'll see it with the naked eye as it whizzes overhead. And the atmosphere is quite difficult to model. You know, the atmosphere is not the easiest thing to put into a computer to calculate friction as this thing whizzes around the Earth. And that's where the uncertainty comes in.
Well, I may or may not be here, but my kids will be and their kids will be, and I guess I'd be concerned for them.
Yeah, and like you said, sooner or later, something is going to happen. You know, it's inevitable that at some point something's going to happen. And again, a city buster hits the Earth every few centuries. Something like this, a nation buster, hits the Earth on a scale of thousands of years. The last one hit Arizona, the famous Beringer crater.
That's
in
right.
Arizona. That hit during the last ice age, causing this huge, gigantic crater to be formed. And then, of course, planet busters, like the one that hit the Yucatan of Mexico, they hit on a rate of maybe once every 10 to 100 million years. So it's just a matter of when. But who knows? We're going to have to keep our fingers crossed in 2029.
We're going to sort of time travel with you in April, Michio. You have a new book coming out where you have interviewed some top scientists about the future.
That's right. You know, I've always been curious about the future, ever since I was a child, watching science fiction and watching Flash Gordon on TV. And now I get to interview the top people, you know, for BBC television, for Discovery Channel. I've interviewed 300 of the world's top scientists. And I've asked them one question: what do you foresee in 20, 50, 100 years? And of course, that's a stretch. But these are the scientists who are inventing the future in their laboratory. These are the scientists on the cutting edge. And so I ask them, what will medical care look like? What will a visit to the doctor look like in 50 years? What about computers? What will computers look like in 50 to 100 years? What about robots? Are they going to take over?
That's going to be an exciting show. We're booked with you already, so you're on.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's going to be a fascinating thing. And I'm going to be on a book tour. So maybe I'll be signing some of your fans' books.
That would be fun. And if you get to Los Angeles, let's get you in the studio too. Michio, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment and take phone calls with you. Plus, I want to get your reaction to the Kepler satellite, the telescope up there that has basically spotted 50 Earth-like planets. We'll be back in a moment. Well, it's called Vaccine Epidemic, and that'll be our topic next hour on Coast to Coast AM. When we come back, more science with Michio Kaku and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. We're with physicist Michio Kaku. We're going to take your phone calls. Michio, the Kepler satellite telescope spotted 50-plus possible Earth-like planets. It's a matter of just time. We're going to realize that there could be intelligent life out there too, huh?
That's right. And if you go to my website, you can find out more about Kepler. It's www.mkaku.org, M-K-A-K-U.org. And you can also find out about my next book, Physics of the Future, by going to the website, mkaku.org, and finding out about my book tour. And yes, the Kepler satellite has located 1,200 possible extrasolar planets, of which 50 of them may be twins of the planet Earth. This is astounding. This means that when you look at the night sky, you will always wonder whether or not somebody is looking back at you from outer space.
When you were a youngster, interested in science, no doubt, did you, without any proof that we had other planets out there, did you believe that we possibly did?
Well, I was convinced that there were other intelligent life forms in the universe. Reading about the Milky Way galaxy and realizing that there are hundreds of billions of stars in the Milky Way galaxy, and the fact that planets are probably common around stars, I figured there must be billions of planets inside the galaxy. And the Kepler satellite is just the first of many satellites that'll pick up thousands of these planets. And that's going to change our worldview. Our understanding of who we are, where we fit into the larger scheme of things, is going to be turned upside down as we begin to home in on these Earth-like twins, find out whether or not they have oxygen atmospheres, whether or not they have water vapor, whether or not they have amino acids, and maybe even complex organic molecules. That's going to change the way we view ourselves and our place in the universe.
I would assume that the folks at SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, would aim their telescope array at these 50 possible Earth-like planets?
Yeah, you know, at the present time, the SETI project has been floundering. There's so many stars. Where do you look? They've only really scanned about 1,000 stars with any particular depth. Now, of course, Paul Allen, Microsoft billionaire, has given over $20 million to SETI so that the Hat Creek installation has many, many times more power, and they can scan 1,000 times more stars than previously. And they'll certainly focus at least on the stars that seem to carry these Earth-like twins around them. And maybe, just maybe, we'll pick up an emission from them, a radio emission.
That would be exciting.
That'll be a real game changer when that happens.
Let's go to the phones. First time caller, Nick in Dallas, Texas. There you go, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, guys.
Hi.
It's a pleasure and honor to speak to both of you. I've listened to George. I listen to you all the time. And Michio, I've read a lot of your books. I admire you guys a whole lot. Michio, I wanted to ask if you could relate physics or science to reincarnation or evolution of the soul?
Well, when it comes to the soul, you know, scientists have tried to actually do a measurement of the soul to measure the body before and after death in order to see whether or not the soul has any tangible qualities to it. So far, we can detect nothing measurable. Science deals, of course, with measurable quantities, reproducible, testable, falsifiable theories. That's the basis of science. So far, we find no evidence of that. However, this has stirred a theological debate within the science community, the question of teleportation. Quantum teleportation is a real possibility. We won't have humans teleported for many centuries, but we can teleport atoms. And then the question is, once you teleport somebody, you have to kill the person in order to teleport them. You actually see the person dissolve and the person rematerializes. But if the person dies and then is reformed someplace else, what happens to the soul?
That's right.
This is a question that physicists have really asked themselves. Is it just information? Information is zapped from one place to another. You just saw Captain Kirk die, and there's this imposter over there with the same memories, the same personality, selling Priceline, everything the same. And then what happened to the soul of the person if Captain Kirk dies and someone over there is resurrected on the other side of the room? It really makes you wonder.
It does. Lets the mind wander. The Hubble Space Telescope, Michio, has photographed the oldest galaxy in space. It's about 13.2 billion years. I mean, not too far after the Big Bang. Is it ever conceivable when we get more and more telescopes up there, better technology, that we're going to be able to see before the Big Bang? And if we do, what do we see?
Well, if you take a look at that Hubble picture of the farthest galaxy ever photographed in the history of the world, you find that there is blackness beyond that galaxy. But that blackness is actually the radiation from the Big Bang itself. You see, the night sky is a time machine. You're looking into the past when you look at these distant galaxies. So when you look in a mirror, for example, you're not really seeing yourself. You never see yourself in a mirror. You see yourself as you were a billionth of a second ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's the time it takes for light to go from your face to the mirror and back to your eyes.
Good point.
So you're looking back into the past, and when you see the farthest galaxy, beyond the farthest galaxy is the explosion itself. The radiation has cooled down to the microwave range. So if you had microwave eyes, you could actually see that beyond this galaxy, there is the explosion. In fact, we have photographed that explosion. Go to NASA.gov, type WMAP, W-M-A-P, the name of the satellite, and you can actually see the fireball. You can actually see the ripples in the fireball of the Big Bang itself, which is still circulating around the universe. The radiation didn't disappear. It's still circulating around the universe. And when you turn on a radio, some of the static you can hear on the radio is actually from the Big Bang itself. It's amazing.
It is amazing. Let's go to first-time caller Wayne in Alexandria, Louisiana. Hi, Wayne. You're up.
Good evening, gentlemen. George, big fan of the show. Dr. Michio Kaku, you are absolutely my favorite scientist to listen to. I've been a science buff my whole life. And you were just speaking of the Kepler telescope, which kind of brought to mind also my comment. I find it difficult to believe. I'm difficult to wrap my brain around an asteroid hitting the planet and, you know, the destruction. I can't wrap my brain around that, of course, as I'm sure a lot of people can. However, having said that, I find it equally difficult to believe that with our technology, with the advances that we've made in the last 20, 25 years, that by 2029, we would not have something to, would have developed something, some type of technology to mitigate something like that coming towards Earth. And what are your feelings on that?
Well, it's a matter of cost. You realize that to put a pound of anything into orbit, just orbit around the Earth, spinning wheels, costs $10,000. So imagine your body made out of solid gold. If you were made out of solid gold, that's the cost of putting you just into orbit around the Earth. Now imagine lofting a huge spaceship into deep space, not just orbit, that can nudge, blast, or push a gigantic asteroid 1,000 feet across. And then you do the math, and then you realize, oh my God, we're talking about a $1 billion mission. Each space shuttle, when it goes up, costs $0.8 billion for each space shuttle shot. That's more than the gross domestic product of some countries. And so it's just cost. We could do it. We could build another booster rocket. But, you know, NASA has budget cuts right now. It's cutting back on the space program. The shuttle is being canceled. The replacement for the space shuttle has been canceled. We're going to rely on Russian rockets to send our astronauts into outer space.
Isn't that amazing, Michio?
Yeah. Who would have thought that the Cold War would end and that we rely on the Russians for access to space? Who would have thought that?
Not me. Well, are you following this apparent shifting of the magnetic poles?
Well, it turns out that if you look at the strength of the magnetic field, it is decreasing. We know that because we have calibrations from the ancient mariners. We know the strength of the the compass needles when they explore the world. And the magnetic field is decreasing. However, it means that at some point there could be a migration or flip of the magnetic poles. But again, it's centuries to millennia in the future. If you go to Hawaii and dig into the magma, the solidified lava flows, you find that the direction of the North Pole has been frozen into the magma. So as you dig into the solidified lava flows, you see that the poles shift. Right there in Hawaii, you can show that the North Pole of the Earth has been shifting. And so some geologists believe that the fact that the magnetic field is dropping on the Earth, slowly dropping, is an indication that at some point it'll flip or perhaps migrate.
Next up, we go to Tom in Washington, Indiana. Tom, you're up with Michio Kaku on Coast to Coast.
Good morning, gentlemen. I've got a question about, I believe the star is called Betelgeuse or something like that, a giant star nearby in the galaxy. What is the chance and what would be the consequences of that thing going supernova?
Well, we all know the constellation Orion, the belt of Orion that was featured in the movie Men in Black.
Uh-huh.
And the shoulder of Orion is Betelgeuse. And it's named after a Babylonian god. It's not named after Michael Keaton. And it's unstable. It's an unstable star. It's a gigantic red giant in the last stages before it explodes. It's 400 or so light years away. So conceivably, it has already exploded. You can't rule that possibility
out. That's a good
point. And we don't know it because it takes 400 odd years for the light to reach the Earth. It is unstable. When it does blow up in a supernova, it'll light up the day sky. It'll be visible in daytime. And at night, of course, it'll outshine the moon. It'll be quite noticeable. It'll cast a shadow. You'll be able to see your own shadow at night cast by the explosion of Betelgeuse. So this is part of the life cycle of stars. Giant stars do blow up. And when they blow up, in their wake, they leave a neutron star and maybe even a black hole. So we may actually be able to see the birth of a black hole in our sector of the galaxy when Betelgeuse blows up. But unfortunately, we don't know when it's going to blow up. Maybe it has already blown up, but we don't know it. Or maybe thousands of years from now, it'll blow up. We simply don't know when it's going to explode.
Many astronomers and physicists now, Michio, are jumping on the multiverse bandwagon.
That's right.
Finally, what pushed them over to the side?
Well, string theory, which is what I do for a living,
uh-huh,
I think had a lot to do with it because string theory has lots of solutions, each one being an entire universe. And so the idea of parallel universes, higher dimensions, that was once considered quackery in physics. But now we have this machine outside Geneva, the Large Hadron Collider, a $13 billion machine that will hopefully test for the presence of a higher dimension, test for the presence of a multiverse.
That would be exciting.
Yeah, and so, again, the Europeans aren't going to spend $13 billion on nothing. They hope to find what is called the Higgs boson, a particle. But in addition, we hope to test the periphery of string theory, which has a number of bizarre predictions, that we live in an 11-dimensional universe, not a 3-dimensional universe, that there could be a multiverse of universes, and our universe could be a soap bubble coexisting in a bubble bath of soap bubbles.
When
these soap bubbles collide, maybe you get Big Bang.
Well, I was going to just ask you that. Maybe that's how it happened.
Maybe that's how we were born. Maybe it was that a soap bubble either split into two or collided with another soap bubble to create our soap bubble.
Could there be another Michio Kaku in another universe simultaneously?
Well, according to ordinary quantum mechanics, there is the many worlds interpretation, which is gaining a lot of adherence recently, especially because of string theory. It means that in some sense, the universe is constantly splitting apart. And it means that in your living room, there are the wave functions of other universes right in your living room, except you cannot communicate with them because they're vibrating at a different frequency. And because we have what is called decohered, we're no longer coherently vibrating with these other frequencies. It's sort of like a radio. A radio exists in a living room with hundreds of radio frequencies, Radio Moscow, Radio Cuba, Al Jazeera, everything exists in your living room, but your radio is only tuned to one frequency. Same thing. In your living room could
Good
be the
point.
Wave function of dinosaurs because that comet missed the Yucatan of Mexico 65 million years ago. But we're no longer vibrating in unison with that universe, so we can't communicate with them. But this also means that in some sense, Elvis Presley is still alive in one of these universes.
Doing his thing. That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Albuquerque, New Mexico. Eric, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hello, hello.
Hi.
Dr. Kaku, this is fascinating. I'm so excited to talk to you. I listen to every episode of Explorations, and I love physics. I could have 100 questions for you, but I think the most interesting one I could ask right now is, what can you tell us about, I think what Einstein used to call something like funky physics at a distance and what we now call quantum entanglement?
Yes, Einstein called this spooky action at a distance. If you take two electrons that are very close together and vibrating in phase, then you separate them. An umbilical cord opens up between these two electrons, and if you jiggle one electron, then in some sense, the other electron senses the presence that its twin is being jiggled. Now, this is spooky because these interactions travel faster than the speed of light. Einstein hated this conclusion because it seemed to violate relativity, where nothing can go faster than the speed of light. But hey, Einstein was wrong. We measure this in the laboratory. This has been measured several times by, in fact, some of my colleagues have done the measurement. And it does seem as if there is this umbilical cord opening up between two objects vibrating in phase. The catch, however, is that the signal does travel faster than light, but it is a random signal. So you cannot send Morse code or you cannot send telegraph messages this way. But we use this quantum entanglement for quantum teleportation. That's how it's done. We teleport photons and atoms by this method. In fact, for the Science Channel, I took a TV crew to the University of Maryland, and we photographed it. We actually photographed the process of an atom zapping across the room, teleporting, just like in Star Trek, teleporting across the room. You couldn't see the atom, of course, but we photographed the apparatus, which detected an atom being teleported right across the room.
When you wrote Physics of the Future, which will be released in April, and you interviewed these top scientists, did you come across anything that was even shocking for you, Michio?
For example, the future of the internet. Everyone assumes that in the future we'll have the internet maybe in our wristwatch, the internet in the wall.
Yeah.
But they tell me that we're going to have the internet in our contact lens. And prototypes are being created right now. And think about that. When you talk to somebody, your contact lens will recognize who that person is and punch out his biography right next to his image as you talk to him. And if he speaks to you in Chinese, it'll be translated on the fly, and you'll see the translation beneath his image in your contact lens.
That is amazing.
So you blink, and you're online.
How about holograms of people when they talk to you via their cell phones?
That's also possible to project images of people as they speak. And the military, by the way, of course, has been looking at this possibility very carefully. I had a chance to fly down with the Science Channel to Fort Benning, Georgia, to see a demonstration.
That's for camouflaging, isn't it?
It's called Land Warrior. It's a small device, like a jeweler's lens, that sits on your helmet. You flick it over your eyes, and you see the entire internet via your helmet.
Gee, that's amazing.
Via a jeweler's lens that erupts. You can see enemy positions, your position, position of airplanes and firepower, the internet of the battlefield.
That's exciting. Michio, we will talk with you, my friend, in April. Dr. Michio Kaku, theoretical physicist. Up next, vaccine epidemic. Stand by.